coalition forces and begin striking selected targets of military importance.
It would be a decision which could only be taken once.
There's no argument over the choice between peace and war.
Unconfirmed reports about Gaddafi being captured.
This morning, I want to talk about the future of Europe.
Burning Point.
Hello and welcome to the show with me, Ekaterina Kudoshkina. The next NPT review conference is planned for the year of 2015. Just to remind our listeners, NPT stands for the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons Treaty. So these conferences are held every 5 years, and last time, back in 2010, the nuclear powers restated their commitment to a, and I quote, diminishing role for nuclear weapons in security policies to minimize the risk that these weapons ever be used and to facilitate the process of their total elimination, end quote. Now, several years later, things seem to be taking the opposite direction. Shortly before leaving his post as the U.S. Defense Secretary, Chuck Hagel authorized the U.S. Department of Defense to request a further 10% increase in funding to upgrade its nuclear infrastructure every year for the next 5 years. He said, and I quote, "Our nuclear deterrent plays a critical role in ensuring U.S. national security, and it is Department of Defense's highest priority mission," Mr. Hagel said. "No other capability we have is more important," end quote. So, does that imply that the NPT is dead? And this is something we are discussing with our guest speaker, Professor Anush Ehtishami of Durham University in UK.
I think it's too early to write it off. I think it's also dangerous to write it off because this is the only internationally binding treaty that we have which can hopefully prevent, but at the very least control, proliferation. And its failure would come at great cost to all of us. And in that regard, then, I hope that, you know, this is not the end, that when the occasion of review comes up in 2015, we can really begin to look at the weaknesses of the treaty and find ways of overcoming those elements.
Professor, but what do you think has been standing in the way of its successful implementation?
I think there are a number of critical issues, one of which, of course, is the difficulties that the five permanent members, you know, the five nuclear states have had in managing reduction. None of them, it seems to me, has any interest whatsoever in reducing the nuclear thresholds below a level which then becomes visible to everybody else. We know that, you know, there is discussions between Russia and the United States about a transition of nuclear weapons, but both countries develop new technologies, warheads. We don't have much of a dialogue with China about these matters. In France and Britain, despite domestic pressures, certainly in Britain, to limit its nuclear program or indeed to end it, the governments of these countries seem to have little appetite for it. And I think the Global South in particular looks at this and sees an inherent bias built into the system, that these countries have nuclear weapons, their programs are accepted through this nuclear regime and can do what they like, irrespective of international requirements. And then a country like Pakistan develops nuclear weapons and India develops nuclear weapons. They are immediately sanctioned by the international community. And then Israel develops nuclear weapons and nothing happens. It is allowed to hold the nuclear weapons. It has developed the nuclear weapons. And yet America remains its closest military partner. North Korea declares that it wants to be a nuclear weapon and is immediately isolated. It is sanctioned. And, you know, its people are starved literally to death. We can't blame the West for this, but I'm just doing a comparison of how countries are treated from the perspective of their compliance with the NPT, if you like. And so North Koreans decide, you know what, we might as well leave the treaty than be subjected to this kind of pressures which is coming upon us. Then there is Iran, which says, you know, we don't actually have a nuclear weapons program. We have a peaceful nuclear program, but nobody believes them for previous transgressions. And they are then subjected to a very intensive international sanctions regime. We don't seem to be judging the world by the same yardstick. And that, I think, at the heart of it is the most important element that needs to be reviewed again. And, you know, when the review takes place, when they look at the additional protocol, which requires a more intrusive investigation and presence of international inspectors in countries like Iran and elsewhere, that they actually look at all the countries with potential nuclear programs equally. This is what every Middle Eastern country wants, that says, look, you know, tell us if Israel's got nuclear weapons and bring it within a controlled international regime. If Pakistan has this nuclear program, make sure that it is part of a broader discussion about counter-proliferation or limiting nuclear proliferation. At the moment, we just kind of marginalize, bypass, dismiss, sanction, or ignore this process which is going on globally.
Our guest speaker is Professor Anush Ehteshami of Durham University in UK.
Burning Point.
And like you're saying, the discriminatory approach is still there. And could it be a reason why all those attempts to hold an efficient conference on creating a WMD-free zone in the Middle East are a failure? Is it the double standard approach?
I think that is absolutely the key issue, that there is double standards. At least that is how the parties see it. For the Arab countries, certainly, before the Iran crisis blew up in 2002, Israel was always in their sight. A nuclear weapons country that was never questioned for its nuclear, clandestine nuclear program. While the rest of the region has been calling for a nuclear weapons-free zone, for example, in the Middle East, Israelis and the West have not engaged in that discussion at all with the rest of the region. And it is that kind of double standard which is obviously taxing the other countries' patience and their attitude towards the international regime. And, you know, they also, though maybe not correctly, also cite what happened to Gaddafi in Libya, where some see cynicism in the West's approach, that the minute he gave up all his defenses in terms of a nuclear, chemical program, missile program, he was totally vulnerable to internal and external pressure. Now, the lessons learned from that can be really dangerous for the rest of us, that if other countries think that, you know what, our protection is only in having a WMD program, it's a recipe for disaster, because what you're doing is encouraging proliferation by that misconception. I don't think myself that Gaddafi's fall was a result of his abandonment of his WMDs. There were very strong domestic reasons for what happened to him. 30 plus years of dictatorship is an obvious case. But nevertheless, it's the lessons that other countries learn from these situations that we need to be really wary of, because they take that degree of cynicism into their negotiations, and they will not look at us as being fair and transparent and applying the same global standard to every country. It is that, again, back to the issue of double standards again, I guess.
But now we have another challenge, and perhaps that could be some kind of a wake-up call. I'm referring to the growing chaos in the region and the emergence of those militant entities. And they have already proved that they have a capacity to get hold of the WMD, chemical weapons, for instance. And chemical arsenal, if we talk about Libya, has been plundered, and the weapons really got into the wrong hands. Couldn't that actually happen to nuclear arsenals?
Oh, absolutely. This is very scary. I agree with you. And we need to be so, so cautious about this and about uncontrolled proliferation. You may recall when the Soviet Union was dissolved, Russia and the United States made a very conscious effort to make sure that the nuclear-related material in Kazakhstan would not be spilling over into wrong hands. And they managed that together very carefully and very well. What is happening now in other places, Syria is another example, where we know that there were stores of chemical weapons now being destroyed that could have fallen in wrong hands. We don't know whether any did or not. And this is a grave cause for concern. Some say that, you know, the West needs to be really vigilant in Pakistan, because it needs to make sure that Pakistan's nuclear facilities are completely safe from Islamist terrorism, for example, and so on. So proliferation increases, if you like, multiplies the dangers of insecurity for those countries and their citizens, but also for the rest of us. And uncontrolled proliferation through non-state actors is something that the regime, the nuclear regime, just doesn't have any means of dealing with, because it is so focused on the state in the review conference that comes up, it needs to begin to take stock of how do you manage control of all nuclear stockpiles. We have the technology for this for a long time at the height of the Cold War. Very clear items were never offered to the Warsaw Pact countries, were kept off the list, and the other side didn't give the West technologies that were seen to be as dual use and so on. We need to revisit all of these criteria and categories to really understand how dangerous proliferation is in this new world and how the key countries, the five nuclear weapon countries, need to work together more closely and show the rest of the world that they're doing this in order to try and bring these unregulated proliferation, if you like, sub-state proliferation under control. But it's a very, very difficult act to undertake. I agree.
This is Burning Point. We're trying to understand what's happened to the NPT treaty. Our guest speaker is Professor Anush Ehtashami of Durham University in the UK. Look, the nuclear weapons are so destructive, they're so dangerous, and they could really, the arsenals could blow up our planet 100 of times, I suppose, though only once is needed, right? And the technologies have been going on. I mean, the technological progress is still on. So is the preservation of the nuclear arsenal that crucial for maintaining the security of a state nowadays?
That is such a good question. When the Cold War ended, there were many who saw in it as an opportunity to begin to really draw down the nuclear arsenals across the world, that if Russia and the US do it, then China, Britain, France, and others will be under pressure to do the same. And as you know, even during the Cold War, the two sides made huge progress in removing some offensive warheads, in extending the lifespan of their negotiations during the Reagan and Gorbachev period in particular. They made real progress. In the 90s, they made real progress. And even in the 2000s, they made progress. But it comes down to politics again. When the two sides have a sour taste in their mouths about each other, all of these other stuff becomes a flashpoint. It's interesting that both militaries recognize that they cannot afford to let the political spats between Washington and Moscow affect their dialogue with each other, because they are the ones who know how bad war is and how dangerous it is to start one and how hard it is to end it.
Absolutely, and all the more so that now there's a new concept saying that limited nuclear war could actually take place, and which means that nuclear arsenals are not deterring a conventional war, and moreover, they are likely to be used in a so-called limited regime, which is, it's awful. I mean, we've seen those dirty bombs being used in several locations in the Middle East, and it's absolutely inhumane. So
I couldn't agree more. The problem, you see, the problem is that military planners talk about tactical nuclear weapons, which are the ones that you can deploy in the field. You know, the technology that the big powers now have, less China, but certainly the other four countries have, means that they can have battlefield-sized nuclear weapons. And if you think about it, if you can actually fit a nuclear warhead in a mortar shell, for example, then you're already assuming your ability to use it in battlefield. And all your potential adversaries will act upon that assumption and will develop a similar countermeasures, either similar weapons or ways of deterring you from using it. And then you get yourself down the same cycle of proliferation and utter madness as it comes down to it, because there is no such a thing as a safe battlefield nuclear weapon, because you cannot control the fallout from the nuclear device once it's been fired. It can harm that particular environment for hundreds of years. It can destroy the neighborhoods outside of the battlefield for hundreds of years. What could possibly justify a military planner to even think about having nuclear weapons in battle? It is totally, as you say, inhumane. And yet, that conversation is being had through defense ministries, and it is really dangerous. And the non-nuclear weapon states in particular become really worried about it, because how do they know that those nuclear countries which have battlefield weapons will not use them against them? What defense do they have? Absolutely nothing. And this is the world of the 18th, 19th century. not the world of the 21st century.
Professor, thank you very much. And just to remind you, our guest speaker was Professor Anush Ehtashami of Durham University in the UK. Well, and with this, we end this edition of Burning Point, brought to you by me, Ekaterina Kudoshkina. Thank you so much for staying with us. Goodbye, and take care.